Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Americans are getting older. Within the decade, it's projected that older adults, 65 plus, will outnumber children under 18 for the first time in U.S. history. And California is home to the largest aging population. Aging in and of itself isn't necessarily bad. People are living longer. But as we get older, the risk for debilitating health conditions increase. A growing awareness and concern in recent decades is the prevalence of dementia and Alzheimer's, which can rob a person's cognition and quality of life. But there are countries with larger, older populations than the U.S., and they offer some good insight when it comes to aging and wellness. Those that lead the pack, like Japan, Italy, and Greece, are home to blue zones, where people are both living longer and healthier. Sacramento County is taking notice and has been selected as the first community in California to use the Blue Zones model to create a dementia-friendly community. Cap Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf got a better understanding of what exactly this means and joins us with her reporting. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Vicky.
So Alzheimer's and dementia, it touches so many lives, my family included. But for those who don't know really how it develops, what are they and how are they different?
So Alzheimer's disease is a disease where there's an abnormal protein and protein structures in the brain, and they create plaques and tangles in your neurons, which affect brain functioning. And it can eventually lead to dementia. But dementia is an umbrella term for conditions that interfere with memory, thinking, and everyday functioning. So you don't have, just because you have Alzheimer's does not mean that you have dementia. And many people have dementia for reasons other than Alzheimer's disease. But they are linked because more often than not, people with Alzheimer's do have dementia.
And this can vary greatly from one person to the next if someone is experiencing this. What did you learn about how it shapes someone's later years in life?
So Alzheimer's can lead to dementia, where someone's cellular functioning deteriorates. And when there's a loss of normal brain functioning, right, particularly regarding memory and cognition, it's extremely difficult for people to take care of themselves, right? So often muscle memory remains intact, right? Someone can get dressed, they can shave, make coffee, sort of seem like they're totally fine, but they're not able to understand their current circumstance or oftentimes navigate the world in the way that they used to be. And eventually, very far down the line, I think I was surprised when I started learning that people can die from Alzheimer's, because I think when I thought about Alzheimer's, I thought about memory loss. But eventually what happens with dementia is people die because they forget how to talk and how to walk and how to eat or drink, right? The brain can no longer functionally support the body.
And there, of course, is a caretaking component to this. And whether if you're a loved one, I mean, there's probably a great deal of learning about this and how to help in the appropriate way. Did you get a sense of the toll and what people have to shoulder when they're caring for a loved one that's going through this?
Right. So I wanted to be sure to spend some quality time with someone with this disease and their loved one, because I know it's such a huge part of so many people's lives. And so I reached out to the Alzheimer's Association, and I got connected with Carlos Olivas III and his dad, Carlos Olivas II, in East Sacramento. And they live in this great home that's full of art. So Carlos II also goes by Charlie. So Charlie helped build this home, and it's just full of his art, his sculpture. And in 2015, the younger Carlos, so Charlie's son, Carlos III, he got a call from Charlie's dentist that said his dad was showing a pattern of not showing up for his appointments and not really taking care of himself. So his hygiene, his oral hygiene as well. So Carlos III came back to care for his dad in 2015. And so for the past 8 years, he's been living in his childhood home, supporting his dad, seeing the progression of this disease, and also trying to live his own life and support his daughter, who's 20. And so he said something that's really important to him is that his dad had long-term care insurance. And so they do have extra support now that his dad needs that. And so Carlos III can work part-time. And he said that's super critical to him. And here's what he said about that.
Gives me respite, gives me time to recharge, refuel, regroup, and reframe my life for a moment so I can come back and have the ability to be positive with my dad, to encourage him to keep on living his life to the fullest so he can draw, so he can laugh at our silly jokes, so we can walk.
Yeah, there's a great deal of love that's attached to this, but then there's also the financial reality that this can be so costly for a lot of families. So the Governor Newsom, when he first took office, like back in 2019, he actually created a task force on Alzheimer's prevention and preparedness. So there's been some awareness and response at a state level for a few years now. What has come out of this task force?
I think the biggest thing that the task force came up with is a set of 10 recommendations that were issued in 2020. So, I think it was really a really high priority. And then because of the global pandemic, things kind of went to the side. But it's still a huge priority, I think, for this administration. And those 10 recommendations included increasing public awareness, launching a caregiving training program, and also developing incentives for people to join the healthcare workforce. Another thing was that they recommended something called Blue Zones. So they said we need to be creating areas in California where we're optimizing the environment so that people can do some low intensity physical activity, have healthy and whole food options, you know, socialize with their neighbors, not smoke as much or use alcohol, and also have a social component, increase volunteerism and improve mental health. So now it's up to the state to start putting this stuff into action.
So instead of just being reactive to people being diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's, it's getting ahead of it and trying to create healthier lifestyles to prevent this or reduce the risk of this happening to residents. So that brings me to Blue Zones. And I briefly touched upon this. And these are areas around the world where people, they're living long while maintaining a quality of life, and that really is the key to this. How does a city or a region get this designation of being a blue zone?
So blue zones, originally, there's these five areas that, including Sardinia in Italy, Okinawa in Japan, and actually Loma Linda in Southern California, where there's a large population of people who are living to be over 100 years old for various reasons, right? But there are some commonalities among them. And so researchers and demographers looked at these areas, saw the trends, and they're about movement, nutrition, connection, purpose, and they really said, let's bring this to the U.S. And crucially, it's not about telling people you need to go on a diet, you need to, be exercising this amount. It's about changing the built environment. It's about changing the options that are available in your local grocery store so that health comes naturally, or it's easy to make the healthy choice.
Yeah. So Blue Zones, they cover so many aspects of wellness, but we're specifically talking about Alzheimer's and dementia. What did you learn about these two diseases when it comes to Blue Zone areas?
So Blue Zone areas tend to have much lower rates of chronic diseases, including brain disease, including Alzheimer's and dementia. So we've done Blue Zones targeted in the U.S. for certain areas where there's high rates of childhood obesity, for instance, or high rates of smoking. And they've done sort of targeted campaigns to lower those specific factors. And so here in Sacramento, they're like, let's do Blue Zones for Alzheimer's and dementia, specifically see how it works and see if we can, extend it out to other communities.
Okay, so where does Sacramento County fit into this?
Well, I know it's been on the mind of Sacramento County health officials for a while. When I first connected with Dr. Olivia Casiria, who's Sacramento's public health officer, she mentioned that one of the top priorities of the area is addressing Alzheimer's deaths. So in 2011, about 387 people in Sacramento County died from Alzheimer's, so almost 400 people. And then in 2021, 10 years later, 814 people died from Alzheimer's. So that was a doubling of Alzheimer's deaths. And it's not because the rate of Alzheimer's is increasing. It's not because it's becoming, more of a insidious disease. It's just because more people are getting older. And it's also become easier to diagnose Alzheimer's. Here's what Casiria said about prioritizing this going forward.
People over the age of 60, that age group is growing larger. And so there's a concern that we need to make sure that we're able to take care of people as they grow older.
Okay, so why was Sacramento County selected as this first city to adopt a blue zone model? I mean, you mentioned Loma Linda is already a blue zone area, but Sacramento County is the first in the state to try to adopt this and become that, a blue zone.
Right. I imagine that there were a number of factors that went into this, but one significant part is that the area is really diverse. And I know we pride ourselves on being a really diverse area. And that's important because chronic disease disproportionately impacts Black and Hispanic people. And Alzheimer's is no different, right? Black folks are affected twice as often as white people. Hispanic people are affected 1.5 times more often. And these people are also diagnosed later with Alzheimer's and dementia. And I wanted to know why this was. You know, why are we seeing these disparities? And I spoke with Dr. Charles DeCarli about this. He's a professor at UC Davis. He directs the UC Davis Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And he says the system of healthcare in America is individual wealth mediated.
In other words, the kind of care you get relates to the amount of wealth you have. And there are great disparities in socioeconomic status between the average non-Hispanic white person living in the United States today as compared to either a Latino Hispanic American or a Black African American.
So we have a great mix of folks of all backgrounds here, so it was deemed a good place to start.
So let's just dive into the details then of this initiative. What could a blue zone in Sacramento County look like?
So that might look like more parks, more bike lanes, more healthy food in grocery stores. It also might look like certain places designated as blue zone spaces. So that's churches, community centers, and those are places where people can practice their faith, you know, volunteer, exercise with others, make social connections that are so crucial to keeping people engaged. A lot of times people find this organically, but when there's like deliberate community involvement, that can be really useful for people.
Yeah, it's convenient. You know, you don't have to work as hard to have a healthy environment. And so another part of this effort also is to be, in quote, dementia friendly. What does that mean?
So dementia-friendly communities, I really enjoyed learning about this because they're communities where people understand what dementia is and are welcoming to those folks. I spoke with the professor from UC Davis, Dr. DeCarli, and he said we don't need to, just because someone has Alzheimer's doesn't mean that they can't be part of society.
For some individuals, they are having some problems, but that does not, one, doesn't lose their individuality. And two, does not require that they be somehow segregated from the environment, but in fact, embraced by the environment and supported. And with a little support, most people, even in the midst of dementia, can do quite well.
So it's also about designing things like public transportation, emergency response, and community programs with people with dementia in mind.
Hmm. What stood out to you most about the conversations you've had? You talked to a lot of people about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really want to bring Charlie into this. And you know, he is the person in living in East Sacramento who has dementia. And, you know, I think his journey with his son has been long and both very rich and also extremely difficult. And I want to bring his voice in because I think it's really important. And I spoke with him and I talked to him about the art he creates because he's still a really wonderful artist. And here's his response to a question that I asked about how he used to make clay pottery.
I had a little kiln that I could still use outside, but I haven't done anything for a year, I guess, now. But, of course, over at Sac State, they had everything, so I just did all kinds of stuff out there. And I give it to people, and I don't even think I've got anything left around here.
So Charlie's had this really rich life with lots of friends all over, and he's still making art, and you can see his work. He's at CharlieBot on Instagram and TikTok, and they're actually planning a gallery show for this amazing art that he does at Art Beat on L Street in Sacramento in January.
Good. I hope that that following goes up. We only have about 20 seconds left, but what are the next steps? What's the timeline, if you can tell us quickly?
So for the next 6 months, they're going to be talking to people in specific areas in North and South Sacramento, and they're going to be finding out what do people need to best have solutions for their areas. So that's going to be in the next 6 months, and you can see a report online at bluezones.com.
And something for you to follow up on.
Definitely.
Thanks so much, Kate.
Thanks, Vicki.
That is CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf discussing Sacramento County becoming the first state to use a blue zone model to curb the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia as our population grows older. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. For those who can and want to have a baby, pregnancy involves a lot of emotions and trips to the hospital, from checkups through delivery. And the overwhelming majority of childbirths happen in a hospital. However, access to maternity wards have dropped in California. The nonprofit newsroom CalMatters found that over the past decade, dozens of hospitals have closed their maternity wards across the state, including portions of the Sacramento Valley, the Central Valley, and parts of the Sierra. And the pace of these closures has only accelerated in recent years. Although California's birth rate has dropped to near record low levels, our state still welcomed nearly 500,000 babies last year. So the loss of these maternity wards means that some communities, especially in rural and low-income areas, are facing additional barriers, from longer travel times or, in the worst cases, no hospitals in their county that can deliver babies. And these findings align with roughly the same time period when pregnancy-related deaths in the state have reached a 10-year high. Ana Ibarra is a health reporter with CalMatters and has been analyzing this drop in maternity care and joins us now. Good morning, Ana.
Good morning, Vicki.
So, Ana, when did you first begin looking into maternity wards across California, across the state?
Yeah, so we've been working on and thinking about this for quite some time now. If you'll recall, earlier this year, we were doing some reporting on the financial troubles of some community hospitals. And we noticed that when these hospitals would reduce services or make cuts in services, one of the first things to go would be maternity wards. And so, you know, we found that really interesting because I think most people, when they think of hospital services, you think of the ER and you think of labor and delivery. So, you know, this seems significant. At the same time, you know, we're aware that nationally, this is something that's been reported in many other parts of the country. Other states have been dealing with a growing number of maternity ward closures for quite some time. We just didn't know what that looked like in California. So that's pretty much what we set out to do.
Yeah. And you and your colleagues, I mean, you looked into records, you dove into the data that was submitted to the state, and you looked at a period between 2011 and 2022, so roughly a decade. In that time, how many maternity wards did you find closed? And did the pace of the closures, did it change during that time frame?
Yes. So in that 10-year period, we counted 46 hospitals that closed maternity wards. Some of those hospitals actually closed completely. And 27 of those closures actually have happened in just the past 3 years. This year alone, in 2023, we've seen 11 hospitals close maternity wards. And, you know, and so when we first started reporting the story was about the closures of this year. We thought, oh, wow, 11 hospitals have closed maternity wards. Then we started comparing it to the previous years, and we started to see, oh, this has been happening for the past 3 years. And, you know, it's grown a lot in those 3 years.
Yeah, more than half of the closures happened in the past 3 years. Given that you focus really on health policy in the state, you have joined us before talking about, you know, closures with a community hospital in the Central Valley. I mean, with that lens that you have, did this surprise you? Has California seen really like a major loss of health services like this before?
Yeah. So what I learned in doing some research is that, you know, back in the late 90s, there was actually this large wave of hospital closures. I believe it was about 24 hospitals that closed entirely. I have, from my research, I didn't see any other major wave of closures until now. I mean, these, it's a little different because those were, you know, entire closures of hospitals. This is a specific service, the maternity ward. But this seems to be, you know, the after that wave in the 90s, this seems to be the next major wave of closures of hospital services.
And when you have, you all have a list of these closures that have taken place within the last decade, and it does touch many parts of the state, including larger areas like Los Angeles County. But when I was honing in our area, I mean, the Sacramento Valley closures were in the North State region in Butte and Colusa counties. There were also maternity ward closures in the Central Valley, like Stockton and Manteca, as well as across portions of the Sierra. What stands out to you about, like, the reasons behind their closures? I mean, I imagine there are individual differences, but did you also notice similar trends?
Yeah, so many of these closures we noticed happened largely in community hospitals. So hospitals that are tend to be independent. They may not have the backing of a larger health system. And, you know, a lot of these community hospitals are located to serve, you know, low-income communities. So they are located in areas where there may be already some issues with medical access. You know, if you ask, when we talk to these hospitals, one of the things they mentioned is because they are located in these areas and they're largely serving low-income families, they rely a lot on Medi-Cal. And the hospitals, you know, main complaint, I think, for those struggling financially was that the what they get paid for Medi-Cal just isn't enough to cover the cost. And so, you know, financials weren't the only reason why these hospitals, you know, may have been closing, but it seemed to play a big role, especially for these community hospitals.
What role does, you know, the fact that California is experiencing a declining birth rate, how does that factor in? Does that play a big role in this as well?
For many hospitals, especially those with that were part of larger health systems, that was actually one of the reasons they noted in their announcements when they would close these maternity wards. You know, many of them said that they were just had seen a steep reduction in the number of births. And so they were choosing to repurpose their birthing centers into other departments where they were seeing higher demands or for services where they were seeing higher demands. So for some hospitals where maybe finances weren't the issue, you know, they decided this, we may repurpose this birthing center into something that, you know, we're seeing more demand of. So I think for some hospitals, this definitely played a role.
So some may think, like, what's the big deal? You can still go to a hospital. Why are maternity wards so important for pregnancies and deliveries?
Yes. So, you know, many of the hospitals we talked to did mention that if you are in an area with no maternity ward, if you go, but you still have a hospital, you can go and deliver in the ER. And, you know, many folks we talked to agreed that that was not the ideal scenario. While it might not be life threatening, you know, that is not ideal. You want, you know, a labor and delivery department has specialized staff, has the OBs, has, you know, the any, you know, specialized staff for babies and the moms. And so, yeah, it is a big deal because you know, I think everyone deserves the best quality of care they can get during this time. And we know that, you know, when one of the big things I think that sometimes gets missed is that when maternity wards close, you may also be losing staff OBs in the area. And if these, you know, obstetricians leave, you may also be losing prenatal care in the area. And that's very important for the health of babies and moms.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many prenatal appointments, routine checkups. And I mean, if you talk to anyone who has delivered a baby, I mean, the experience can vary greatly from one person to the next, and there can be complications, and they usually come up in the heat of the moment. So it's good to have a specialist on hand that can address it immediately. Ultimately, like, what does this mean for patients? Because there are, I mean, your findings found that there are, what, a dozen counties that don't have hospitals that deliver babies.
Yes, that's correct. So for patients, especially, I think in more rural areas, this means longer drives to get to a hospital, an hour or two in some cases. If, you know, when I was down in Imperial County, I went down there to report because Imperial County just, I think, had really interesting example. And I learned that, you know, it's well known among residents that the single hospital left doing births in that county is pretty overwhelmed. And, you know, an OB there that works in that hospital, you know, confirmed that with the closure of one of their maternity wards, that means that their other hospital now has to absorb the influx of patients. And there have been instances where they have delayed some scheduled deliveries. So, you know, it's the longer drives, but also these potential delays in care that is also a consequence.
Hmm. And I would imagine, you know, Imperial County, as you, the reason why you went down there, it's a great example of the problems that are arising from this. On the flip side, there are areas that really are faring better. When I looked around Sacramento and the county surrounding Sacramento, they weren't on the list. Is there a reason why some regions like Greater Sacramento are faring better than others?
Yeah, you know, I think my estimated guess would be part of the reason why Sacramento has been spared is because you do have mostly large health systems in the area. You have the Kaisers, you have the Sutters, the UC. These systems overall tend to weather financial and staffing challenges a lot better. They are in a better position to keep and continue these types of services. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with CalMatters health reporter Ana Ibarra about the closing of maternity wards across California. Ana, I mean, you document this as well in your reporting, but this also comes as California is facing an ongoing maternal mortality crisis. I mean, state data shows that pregnancy-related deaths reached a 10-year high in 2020. So is there a correlation with the drop in maternity wards and deaths that are preventable?
So that's one of the things we're working on next. We are trying to figure if this is playing a role in that, because, you know, California for many years was actually seeing a downward trend when it came to pregnancy-related deaths. In 2012, the state recorded its lowest rate of maternal deaths. And then the numbers started to go up. And in 2020, like you said, it recorded its highest rate yet. So about 19 deaths for every 100,000 births. And, you know, we know that these mortality rates are worse for certain groups like Black women. So, you know, that is, we know that this could potentially play a role. What we're trying to figure out next is how big of a role are these closures playing in these mortality, growing mortality rates,
How are these closures even notified to the public? I mean, what reactions have there been to these closures from both officials, but also just people who live in the community?
Yeah, so most of the time, of course, women will learn from their doctors, their OBs, you know, that their local hospital is closing and that they might need to make new plans. Most hospitals will have some sort of announcement. It'll be posted on their website that'll say, you know, as of starting this date, we'll be closing maternity services. But for a lot of people, these announcements come as a surprise. Again, just going back to Imperial County, because I was there, you know, a lot of people said they were really surprised when this announcement came. The public kind of, because they were given about just a few weeks notice, and they didn't seem very prepared. People were very concerned. They knew that there was one other hospital in the county, and so they knew they had that one option. Some women said that it was common for them to start looking in whether they would have to go to another county or whether that one hospital that was left in their area would be able to take them. So, yes, a lot of concern and surprise for some residents.
From the hospital standpoint, I mean, you also detail that there was also difficulty for some hospitals just finding staff. I mean, they had vacancies for extended periods of time. What did you learn about how challenging it's been to recruit people to take part in a maternity ward, to work there?
Yeah, I think this was especially the case for some rural counties where I think it's always been a challenge to recruit staff there. But some of those hospitals said that for them, it wasn't an issue of money. It was an issue of staffing, where they were having just years of, like you said, vacancies, and they were just having a hard time retaining and contracting both nurses and OBs. And we know that a hospital needs, you know, a certain number of workers to keep these safe staff to patient ratios. So for them then becomes an issue of liability. If you can't keep those ratios, those, you know, wards staffed appropriately, then it became a question of, you know, do we have to close this maternity ward?
Yeah, because it becomes a safety issue as well, and people need practice, especially when it's a specialty, something like this. Finally, Anna, I mean, when it comes to solutions, what solutions are out there from a state level or a local level to help, you know, alleviate these issues?
Yeah, so because this is, you know, I think like there's many factors playing into these closures, it would probably require several types of solutions. I mean, when we talk to community hospitals, the first thing they mention is, well, you know, if we had better reimbursement from insurers, including Medi-Cal, then maybe, you know, they could be more sustainable. Like I said, for some it's staffing, you know, how do we get more people through these pipelines and into these hospitals, especially in more remote areas? You know, there's also talk from some groups like midwives of whether, you know, we should be looking more at alternatives like freestanding birthing centers, whether, you know, we should be building more of those and how, you know, how difficult is it to get those in more remote areas? So there's some conversations. I don't think that there is like a one, you know, fix that will or one solution that will fix it all. But, you know, I think there are multiple conversations to be had.
Ana Ibarra is a health reporter with the nonprofit newsroom Cal Matters, who's been looking into the increasing number of maternity ward closures across California. Thanks so much, Ana.
Thank you, Vicky.
You're listening to Insight. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There's a buzz in Tahoe these days. It's the buzz of ski resorts making snow. And this comes off of the doozy of last season, storm after storm setting snowfall records. Some would say it was too much of a good thing. Even ski resorts and businesses had to close at times because the conditions were so bad. Right now, though, the forecast seems kind of lackluster. It's leading several ski resorts like Sugar Bowl, Sierra at Tahoe, Heavenly, and others to postpone their opening days. Joining us from their vantage points of the Sierra are Davis Bedient with Donner Ski Ranch in Soda Springs and Paul Raymore in North Tahoe at Diamond Peak Ski Resort in Incline Village. Good morning to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So, hey, good morning.
Good morning. Davis, I want to start with you. Tell us where Donner Ski Ranch is located, how you and your team are getting ready for the upcoming season.
Yeah, we're located at the top of Donner Summit, about as high up here as you could get. Right now, to get ready for the season, we're just doing a bunch of last-minute maintenance on chairlifts and kind of running around trying to get everything all sealed up before the snow really starts to fall. We're pretty different than a lot of resorts up here. We don't make snow. We rely on natural snowfall, so as far as opening and closing dates, we just tell people we open up when there's snow and we will close down when there's no more snow. So right now, just doing projects and waiting for the snow to fall.
Yeah, you are located in a beautiful area. My husband and I were there like over the summer, and where there were like PCT hikers like making their way through, which was a pretty cool experience to take in. Donner Ski Ranch also has a lot of history. I mean, you're one of the few remaining family-owned resorts.
Yeah, totally. Completely family-owned and operated. The owners are here every single day baking pies, running chairlifts. It's about as family-oriented as you could get. We all have Thanksgiving dinner together. We all have Christmas dinner together. And we all live up here as well. So it is just one big family that keeps this resort going.
Yes, we did have a slice of that pie. It is delicious. I highly recommend people get the pie from Donner's Ski Ranch. All right, Paul, you're over on the Nevada side in Incline Village. You know, talk to us about how things are shaping up with Diamond Peak.
Yeah, we are also kind of in our final preparations. We are scheduled to open in exactly 1 week on Thursday, December 7th. So every moment that we've got the right temperatures and conditions, all of our snow guns are firing, all of our slope maintenance crews are out there, either making snow or grooming that out, getting the runs ready for opening day. And we're certainly doing our snow dances and hoping for a little bit more help from Mother Nature. It's always good to get some natural snow on top of what we can produce with those snow guns.
What are the ideal conditions for snow guns to produce snow?
Ideally, nice cold temperatures and low humidity really helps with the production of those snow guns. But, you know, our crews are as versatile as they can. And so, you know, they'll be turning the guns on up at the top of the mountain when it's colder up top, but not at the base. Sometimes vice versa, if there's some kind of temperature inversion. So it's a 24/7 job during this early preseason. They're up all night and just making as much snow as possible whenever conditions allow.
Yeah. I mean, Paul, you've been in Tahoe for a long time. And Davis, as you mentioned, you and the Donner Ski Ranch crew, you live up there in Soda Springs. So I imagine both of you are very familiar with like the ebb and flow from one winter to the next. I mean, how do you navigate that, Paul, over at Diamond Peak?
It is one of the interesting but also really enjoyable things about being in this industry. You never know what you're going to get until you get into that season. And even then, things can change, you know, on a dime, depending on the storm cycles. Last year was one that we certainly won't forget. Tons of snow, all those atmospheric rivers that hit the Tahoe area and delivered, as you mentioned, sometimes a little bit too much snow. It made things challenging, but it was also a lot of fun. And so we're really looking forward to what this winter brings. Everyone in this industry is pretty adaptable and able to take what Mother Nature throws at us and make the best of it.
Davis, how do you and the Donner Ski Ranch family, you know, kind of ride out, you know, the ebb and flow from one winter to the next?
Yeah, totally. We're pretty fortunate being high up in elevation that a lot of times if lower elevations are getting rain, we might be right at the snow level. And so we are very fortunate with that. We also kind of just do whatever we can. We have our tubing hill that we can try to keep running as much as possible. We'll farm snow from off the resort to keep stuff going. But yeah, just like Paul said, on high snow years, it almost becomes more difficult because then you're trying to figure out what to do with all the snow. You run out of places to put it and it starts hampering where you can park cars and where you can get people. And so it's hard. I don't know that I've ever lived here on a year where I've said, oh, you want to know what? This is the perfect amount of snow. I wish we had no more and no less. I feel like up here and everywhere around Tahoe, it's always like, oh, come on, we need some snow. And then, oh, geez, when is it going to stop snowing? So just doing whatever we can. We also have our bar and restaurant up here that's open 7 days a week, 364 days a year. We close down for Thanksgiving, but other than that, yeah, we just kind of do what we can to provide a good quality service for everyone up here on the summit, as well as anyone that wants to drive up here.
Yeah, and you're at the resort right now, you know, perched high at the summit. You know, given that Donner Ski Ranch, I mean, every, I think, resort has its own kind of character and its own style. You know, what does that mean for the visitor who goes to Donner Ski Ranch? You know, what's special about it?
Yeah, totally. I would say two big things. We're very fun and family oriented. We like to get beginner skiers up here. We do a lot of deals with tickets and rentals. I think right now, I think we're still working on our ticket prices, but I know last season weekends, we were selling lift tickets for $99. And then we do old school days, Tuesday through Thursday, non-holiday, where I believe last year our tickets were $59. As well as we discount rentals for that. And we really try to get beginner skiers up here. But we also have some great terrain for the more advanced skier. We don't have a ton of vertical feet, but we have, I like to tell people, it's kind of like mini golf. It's not anything big, but it's really fun.
Yeah, Paul, you know, for someone who wants to try skiing or snowboarding, I mean, there can be kind of like a sticker shock in the beginning because you had to rent gear. You know, what advice do you have for someone that's going to go to Diamond Peak for their first time? And are there ideal conditions or a good time to learn?
You know, I think what I would always tell people is start at one of the smaller resorts. Donner Ski Ranch is a great example of that. Diamond Peak's another one. We're both independent. Over here at Diamond Peak, we're actually community owned by the community here in Incline Village. And so it makes it just a more laid back, easier resort to navigate, especially if you're a beginner coming in. There's not going to be huge crowds. You're not going to get stuck in huge lift lines. And so you're going to get a lot more time on the snow. If you're new to the skiing or snowboarding, I always recommend start with a lesson. You know, smaller resorts usually have some kind of great lesson package deals that make it more affordable. You get your lift ticket, you get your lesson, and you get your rental equipment. Typically, you can start with the morning lesson, take a break for lunch, and then practice on the snow on your equipment for the afternoon. And that's a great way to get a taste. And then if you're into it, just come back as much as possible. We honestly have people who pick up skiing in a lesson and decide to purchase a season pass that next day because they loved it so much and they know they're going to get their money's worth. And that's a great way to make it more affordable if you're coming up and visiting more than, you know, 4 or 5 days, then typically a season pass will pay for itself.
Yeah, I went like in a recent year with a big group that were taking lessons for skiing, and it can vary dramatically, you know, who gets it, you know, the first try and who does not. So it can vary very greatly from one person to the next. For people who go to Diamond Peak every season, is there anything new this season, Paul?
They will see some improvements in our Base Lodge food court we're excited about. Just make that kind of lunchtime experience more pleasant and a more efficient flow in our kitchen area. We also added a brand new winch snowcat, which is going to be behind the scenes. No one's going to see that in operation. It's happening at night while the snow slope maintenance team is grooming the slopes. But it will add to their efficiency and allow us to maintain kind of our reputation for providing really nice corduroy on some of our steeper groom slopes. So we're very excited about both of those. And then we've also just got a new brand new Salomon snowboard rental fleet in our rental shop. So brand new equipment for folks who are renting snowboards this year, as well as some fun new demos coming in for people who want a little bit higher end performance equipment.
And I noticed, I think I'm correct, you're still hiring for the season. What do you want people to know if they're interested?
Yeah, just that working at a ski resort is a very fun job. As David said, it's a very family feel. At these smaller resorts, you'll get to know everyone. You'll get a chance to meet everyone from our general manager down to the folks parking your cars. We have a lot of fun perks that we try and provide to our employees. And there's opportunities to work inside, outside, full-time, part-time, or even just weekends and holidays, because that is the busiest time for ski resorts.
And I know Diamond Peak is a week away from its opening day. Davis, are you guys mulling around or hoping for have you narrowed in on an opening day for Donner Ski Ranch?
We just need about a foot of snow. so they keep on tricking us with the weather. I think it's one of the few jobs you could just be wrong all the time and keep your job. But we're just waiting for a storm to come in and not move everything right now. Seems like it's moving north of us. But waiting for a storm to come in, we need about a foot of snow. The resort's all mowed down and ready to go. Our snowcats are all tuned up and good to go. So a foot of snow and we'll open up.
Well, thanks, Davis and Paul, for joining us.
Thanks. Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Davis Bedian is with Donner Ski Ranch in Soda Springs, and Paul Raymore is with Diamond Peak Ski Resort in Incline Village. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to talk to us, you can shoot us an email at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.